Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today we're tackling something really fundamental for global business, especially if you're maybe newer to corporate tax or transfer pricing.
Yeah, it's a big one.
We're talking about how you put a price tag, a defensible price tag on assets you can't, well, physically touch. The basics of pricing intangible assets.
And it's an area that honestly causes a lot of confusion. Our sources show that, yeah, lots of companies set compensation for these assets, but often the thinking behind it, it can be a bit shaky or sometimes just not there at all.
Right.
So our goal today is pretty straightforward. We want to give you a clear structure, you know, based on the main ways the industry approaches this. So you understand not just how to get a number, but really how to stand by that number when tax authorities come knocking.
Okay, let's unpack that, because we're dealing with the core of what makes many modern companies valuable, aren't we? The IP, the brands, the secret sauce, the stuff driving profits. So before we get into the pricing itself, we probably need a common definition. What are intangible assets in the eyes of, say, the OECD or a tax authority?
Good starting point.
Yeah.
Yeah, we usually lean on the OECD's transfer pricing guidelines here. They define them pretty broadly. Think of them as assets that are owned or controlled, used in business activities.
Okay.
And this is key. They're assets where compensation gets paid when they're used in transactions between related companies, like a parent company and its subsidiary.
So not physical goods, not purely financial things like loans.
Correct. They're the non-physical property that gives a company its competitive edge.
And the typical scenario is that cross-border licensing or maybe a transfer, right?
Yeah.
Parent company to a subsidiary.
That's very common. And the kinds of assets moving around, well, the sources list quite a few.
Like what?
You've got the technical stuff, like specific manufacturing technology or that valuable manufacturing know-how. Then the more market-facing things, trademarks, obviously.
Mm.
But also things like designs or technical drawings. And then assets that help you actually sell stuff, like access to an established sales network, or maybe a specific sales license for a territory.
Wow, okay. That list really shows how broad this is. It's basically anything the subsidiary uses that adds value but didn't originate with the subsidiary itself.
Pretty much, yeah.
Which brings us to the big question. How on earth do you set an arm's length price, a fair royalty rate for something like knowledge or a brand name, when there isn't, you know, an obvious open market price tag?
Ah, yes. And that leads us straight into the three main valuation approaches. These are the accepted frameworks for figuring out that royalty rate.
Okay, the three pillars. Let's start with the one tax authorities often say they prefer, even it sounds like the hardest one, the market approach.
Right, the market approach. Or you might hear it called the comparable uncontrolled transaction method, the CUT method.
CUT method, okay.
The idea is simple. Value your intangible based on what price or royalty rate comparable assets fetch between completely unrelated parties out in the open market.
Simple idea, but how do you do that?
Well, it means digging into specialized databases. Think royalty stat, royalty range. There are others. And you use these to find contracts between third parties for similar intangibles. Then it's a lot of screening work, quantitative and qualitative.
Hold on. Finding a truly comparable third-party deal for unique IP sounds? Or incredibly difficult. Most tech, most brands, they're unique, right? Confidential, even.
That's precisely the challenge. It is difficult.
So why is it the gold standard if finding a perfect comparable is almost mission impossible?
Because, in theory, it's the closest reflection of the arm's length principle, what independent parties would genuinely agree to.
Yeah.
But you're right, pure comparables are rare. So in practice, a lot of the work involves documenting why your chosen comparables are comparable enough, adjusting for the differences and justifying those adjustments.
I see.
The goal isn't always a single perfect number, but establishing a range, a defensible royalty rate range based on market evidence.
Okay, so it's about building a justifiable case using imperfect market data. What if that external view just doesn't work? The asset is too unique. No decent comparables exist. Where do you go then?
Then you typically look inwards, which brings us to the second pillar, the cost approach.
Cost approach. So valuing it based on what it costs to make.
Essentially, yes.
Yes.
Either the actual historical costs spent developing it or sometimes what it would cost to reproduce it today. From an accounting perspective, this feels more straightforward, maybe.
Easier to track the costs, I guess.
It can be, but it's generally seen as the least reflective of actual market value.
Yeah, I can see a potential flaw there. I mean, couldn't a really inefficient R&D team spend a fortune creating something that ends up not being very valuable in the market?
Exactly.
But under the cost approach, they'd still try to charge a royalty, based on those huge costs, right? That doesn't seem right economically.
Yeah. You've nailed its main limitation. The methodology is basically add up all the relevant R&D costs, salaries, lab equipment, rent, maybe some executive time. Mm-hmm. And then you set a royalty rate designed simply to recoup those costs over the asset's expected life. It doesn't really measure market success or failure.
So tax authorities probably aren't huge fans of this one.
Generally, they view it with skepticism. Unless maybe the asset is brand new, hasn't proven itself commercially yet, or perhaps if the whole setup is a formal cost-sharing agreement where that's the explicit deal.
Okay, so market approach looks outside. Cost approach looks backward at expenses, which leaves the third pillar. This one often feels the most complex, but maybe the most economically logical. The income approach?
The income approach, yes. This one tries to capture the actual economic benefit the intangible generates.
How does it work? Discounting future cash flows.
That's the core mechanism, yeah.
Yeah.
Discounting the expected future cash flows generated because of the intangible asset back to the present value. But the really interesting part here, the tricky part, is isolating the value purely from the intangible.
What do you mean, isolating it?
Well, you need to do a proper functional analysis. You look at the subsidiary using the IP. You figure out the total profit it's making.
Right.
Then you have to figure out how much profit that subsidiary should be making just for doing its basic job.
Hmm.
You know, manufacturing the thing, selling it, distributing it. Its routine functions.
Like a standard margin for being a distributor, say.
Exactly. You estimate that routine margin. Anything the subsidiary earns above that routine profit.
Hmm.
Well, the argument is that excess profit is largely thanks to the contribution of the intangible asset it's using.
Ah, I see. So the royalty is set to capture that excess profit.
Precisely. You're effectively working backward. You determine an appropriate profit level for the licensee's own functions, and the rest, more or less, is attributed to the IP and paid back as a royalty.
So if a subsidiary using the parent's tech is hugely profitable, the income approach would suggest a high royalty because the IP must be driving that success.
That's the logic. But it requires really linking these valuation methods back to who actually creates the value. Which brings us neatly to the OECD's DEMP framework.
DEMP. Okay, this sounds important. Maybe a bit like jargon, but you're saying it's key to justifying the price.
It absolutely is. DEMP-E. It stands for Development, Enhancement, Maintenance, Protection, and Exploitation. Five key functions related to intangibles.
Development, Enhancement, Maintenance, Protection, Exploitation. Got it.
The crucial insight for pricing is this. Who deserves the profits generated by the intangible? Well, it depends on which entity performs these DEM functions, and importantly, who bears the risks associated with each function.
So it's not just about who legally owns the IP.
No, not anymore. It's about who does the work and takes the risk. If you, as the licensor, want to claim a high royalty, you need to demonstrate that you're performing the critical DEMP functions and bearing the associated risks.
Okay, let's make that concrete. Give me an example. Say protection. What does that involve?
Sure. The protection function covers things like securing the legal rights patents, trademarks registering them, defending them against infringement, monitoring competitors. If the parent company handles all that legal work and cost, they're performing the protection function and bearing that risk.
Makes sense. What about, say, exploitation? That sounds like just using it.
Pretty much. Exploitation is about the actual use of the intangible asset in the course of business to generate profit. Typically, the licensee does this. They should earn a return for that effort, of course.
But the extra profit derived from the unique value of the intangible itself, that's what the royalty aims to capture, based on who performed the other DEMP functions, like development or enhancement.
Exactly. A transfer pricing audit will literally map out which company did the development, who's doing ongoing enhancement, who's maintaining the asset's value, who's protecting it, who's exploiting it, and do the payments align with that functional reality and the risks each party took.
This DEMP analysis sounds critical for defending your pricing, then. It's not just about picking one of the three methods.
It underpins everything. You need to connect the pricing method to the DEMP reality.
Okay, let's put some numbers on this. Because theory is one thing, but how do these different approaches actually translate into royalty rates in practice? Our sources had some examples, right?
They did. Let's look at the cost approach example first. Imagine the total R&D cost to develop an asset was, say, 400 million currency units.
Okay, 400 million spent.
The company might decide, okay, we want to recoup this over maybe 5 years.
Yeah.
If this subsidiary using this asset has annual sales of, let's say, $1.6 billion,
right.
A 5% royalty rate on those sales would bring in $80 million per year. Over 5 years, that's $400 million. Cost recovered. It's purely a backward-looking calculation based on recouping investment.
Simple math, but ignores market value, as we said. Now, compare that to the market approach using the same sales number.
Right. Using those external databases, maybe the analysis shows comparable uncontrolled transactions have royalty rates ranging from, say, 1% up to 5%.
A range, okay.
Within that range, maybe analysis suggests the middle point. Or perhaps a specific percentile like the median is most appropriate. Let's say that points to a rate of 3.00%. That's your justifiable royalty based on external benchmarks. Completely different logic.
Outward looking. And then the income approach. How might that play out with $1.6 billion in sales?
Okay, income approach is forward looking, remember. You analyze the subsidiary's business. You determine that for its routine functions manufacturing, selling it should earn a target operating margin of, let's say, 5% of its sales.
So 5% of $1.6 billion, that's $80 million, that's its routine profit.
Exactly. But maybe the subsidiary is actually earning significantly more than that because the IP is so valuable. To get the subsidiary's profit down to that target $80 million, you calculate the payment needed. If that required payment happens to be, say, another $80
million. Then $80 million divided by $1.6 billion sales, that's also 5%.
Coincidentally, yes, in this example, it could be different. But the point is, you might arrive at similar rates, 3%, 5%, 5%, via radically different methods. And your justification, your audit defense file, will look completely different for each one.
That really highlights why just picking a number isn't enough. The why and the how, based on the approach and the Dempy analysis, are crucial, especially given the scrutiny.
Intense scrutiny. Which leads us to some really important caveats, some warnings, when you're actually setting these prices. Choosing the method that just gives you the answer you want, that's asking for trouble.
What are the big risks?
Well, with the market approach, the big one is disagreement. Tax authorities in the subsidiary's country might look at your chosen comparable deals and say, nope, we don't think those are comparable enough.
Ah, so what's acceptable in one place might not be in another.
Exactly. You might need upfront certainty, maybe through something like an advanced pricing agreement, an APA, to lock it down and avoid disputes later.
Okay. And the income approach. Calculating that excess profit sounds like it could be a red flag for auditors, too.
Definitely high risk. Tax authorities can really push back on income approach calculations, especially if it looks like the subsidiary is paying almost all its profit back to the parent as a royalty.
They'd argue the subsidiary is just a shell, not getting fair compensation for its own activities.
Precisely. They'll argue the local entity deserves a bigger slice of the pie for performing its functions, even if they are routine. You need robust justification for that profit split.
We also need to think about the payment structure, right? Like fixed fee versus a percentage of sales. Does that matter?
It does. You first need to justify the base. Usually net sales is common and makes sense. If you opt for a fixed royalty, like a set amount per month,
yeah.
Be prepared for tax authorities to question it if the subsidiary sales or profits fluctuate wildly. They might say the fixed fee isn't reflecting the actual contribution. Variable royalties tied to sales or profit often feel more aligned with the arm's length principle because the payment moves with the subsidiary's success.
That makes sense. And one last big one. Technology gets old. Brands can fade. What about changes over time?
Crucial point, especially for long-term licenses. You absolutely need to consider rate adjustments. If the technology becomes outdated or the market changes, the intangible just isn't contributing the same value it did initially.
And the tax authorities will notice that.
You bet they will. They'll argue the royalty rate is now too high and demand to be lowered.
Mm-hmm.
So best practice is to build a review mechanism into the original agreement. Plan for how you'll reassess the value and the rate periodically to reflect potential obsolescence or changes.
Okay, so let's try and wrap this up. It seems setting a price for intangible assets isn't just about picking one of these three calculation methods. It's much deeper.
Much deeper.
It's about doing that functional analysis, the Dempy stuff, figuring out who does what and who takes the risk. Then you need to choose and apply a valuation method consistent with that analysis. And finally, you have to package it all up with solid documentation that aligns with international tax rules.
That's it in a nutshell. What really matters, what stands up to scrutiny, is the detailed analysis proving that the payment, the royalty, truly reflects the asset's contribution and the risks taken by the licensor, all within the context of the whole business. It's complex.
It really sounds like it.
Yeah.
Which leads us to a final thought for you, our listeners, to consider. We heard that many companies, maybe historically, set their royalty rates based on tradition or just plucked a percentage out of the air, sometimes with no real rationale behind it.
Mm-hmm. That happens.
So given how complex this DEMP-B framework is and how much focus tax authorities globally are putting on transfer pricing, if your company's royalty rates were set up years ago, perhaps without this kind of detailed functional and economic defense, how should you be thinking now about proactively auditing those arrangements? How can you ensure they're robust enough to withstand the inevitable scrutiny that's likely coming down the line?
That's a really important question for many businesses right now. Food for thought.
Definitely something to think about. We'll leave you with that. Thanks for joining us on The Deep Dive.
Thanks, everyone.
We'll see you next time.